is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Jonathan Vlashuk about his new book called An Alternative History of Cleveland, which I think is a really interesting book, and I think will surprise you in many ways, because not just, I think the sense of it, when you say alternative, it may give connotations that are different from what John has done. So, John, I want to welcome you to the show, and thanks for coming.
Happy to be here, David. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, so maybe you could talk a little bit about yourself before we talk about the book and your background. I know you're from Ohio, but I think you were originally from Northwestern Ohio, not from Cleveland itself. And although, you know, I know they're close, but maybe you could talk a little bit about your background and what got you interested in writing about the background of Cleveland, the story of Cleveland in a different way.
I grew up in Northwest Ohio. My first home was in this little town called Archbold, and I actually wasn't born there. I was born in the county hospital, which is in Bryan, Ohio, which was the big city. It's a small farming village, and that's where my family's from. But like many places here in the Midwest, we kind of fall in the shadow of one or another media market. And for folks in Northwest Ohio, you know, some of the pickups would have, you know, University of Michigan, Detroit Lions, stickers on them. And then some of them would, you know, they would be Buckeyes fans and they would look to Cleveland. And you could, on the radio, get either radio market. And my family just happened to be a Cleveland-oriented market, even though many neighbors were looking towards Detroit. And so I grew up looking towards Cleveland. I was cursed with being a Cleveland sports fan from birth, because that's what my parents gave me. And so even after I moved away from there, and I spent part of my childhood in Los Angeles, and then I went to high school in Dayton, Ohio, and Southwest Ohio, I still carried that with me, and Cleveland was very much on my mind, until fate would have it that I, in graduate school, came to Case Western Reserve University 20 years ago now, and since then, I've made this my home. I've raised two kids here, and so that is my background and my connection to Cleveland. And in school, I was always really fascinated with the natural world. You know, I'm a kid of programs like Carl Sagan's Cosmos in the early 1980s. And I wanted to do something in education, science education in that way. And when I went to Ohio State to get my bachelor's degree, I was considering going into meteorology. And then I hit, I think it was in my junior year, I hit the math, and that was a big problem. And I had a great mentor there in the history department, John Brook. And he said, you know what, you are, you're a pretty good writer. You know what, there's this field, kind of an emerging field called environmental history. You can look at the same things, study the human-earth interaction, and you don't have to worry about numbers so much. And by the way, there's some really interesting people studying that all over the United States. But one of them is at the University of Montana, and he's doing place-based studies. Bioregionalism is what it was called. And so when I graduated, I got into a U-Haul and took my young, my oldest was a week old, went to Missoula, Montana. And I started my graduate education there, focusing on environmental history. When I came back to Cleveland for, that was my MA program, when I came to Cleveland for my PhD, I continued that, but I was more interested in studying urban environmentalism. Out in the West, they're very much focused on bioregionalism and the West as place. In the Midwest, we have kind of an underdeveloped sense of ourselves as a region, because the other regions, there's a long story there, but other regions have gained more more attention in history departments. The American South, the American West, of course, New England, and the Midwest, which has a really unique history, has kind of been underdeveloped from a theoretical standpoint, and just from people growing up here, going to college, and then studying and telling stories about their own places. And that's what I wanted to do. And I thought there was a wonderful opportunity, because right here in Cleveland was the birthplace of the modern oil industry. Standard Oil Corporation was founded here, and that became my doctoral dissertation. It was in part urban history, because it was telling the story of the kind of the Industrial Revolution in Cleveland and the birth of that industry. And that led me to all sorts of questions that I couldn't answer in that book while I was in the archives talking to people. That led then to this book. So that is my background. That's my journey. That's how I got to writing a very unconventional book about Cleveland history.
Oh, no, it makes sense. I think that's actually, you know, it's, there's some resonance for me, because years ago I studied biogeography. I went to graduate school and worked in field biology and kind of got interested in, you know, a similar area. I just didn't pursue it. But I think that the interaction of humans and the earth, which also kind of crosses over really in interesting ways with geography, you know, the history of the land, it was sort of how it was put traditionally, but it's more than the land. There's, and as we've kind of come to realize now, and I think as you talk about in the book, human interaction with the landscape is not new. We, you know, in our modern perspective, we kind of always look at what we do as if we're the only ones who ever were here. And I think in a lot of ways, that's really what your book, the alternative element of your book, is asking us to look at it differently, outside of ourselves, outside of what we see right in front of us, to try to decode what was there before, going back for, you know, at least you go back some thousands of years, not like a geologist or might do millions of years. I thought it was a really, I thought it was a really good way to enter, although you didn't start by telling us that at the very beginning. And I thought that one of the ideas, you know, you sort of tell stories throughout the book about things that happened, and you make those the entry points into a kind of meditation, if you will, on a part of what you're interested in. You know, one of those things, and I'm not trying to do the talk about the book in absolute order, and I think people should read it for themselves, but I really thought it was interesting how you talked about the blackout of 2003, which, A, I'm not sure, I don't remember that event, even though it was a really big deal and I should. And I thought it was really interesting that it gave you a chance to talk about so many different parts of not just the story of Cleveland, but the story of America in our technological bubble, you know, that when the lights go out, everything changes. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was great when you talked about the, for the first time, people got to see the sky.
Yeah. For me, it harkened back to a memory I had in childhood that was, in retrospect, one of those awakening moments. I was maybe 7 years old in Los Angeles, and I lived in a community called Buena Park, which is close to Anaheim. I could see the fireworks from Disneyland from my where I lived. And so light pollution was blinding there. There was no seeing the night sky. But my parents, being good Midwesterners, felt a little uncomfortable about there not really being seasons in Los Angeles. So they would take us as much as possible, me and my sister, out to the national parks in Los Angeles, out to the mountains in winter, because, you know, a Midwesterner without snow in winter was unheard of. And so I remember vividly the first time we went to Death Valley, and it's an amazing desert environment, unlike any other place on Earth. It's the lowest point in North America and consistently records some of the hottest temperatures on the planet. But the thing that just struck me more than anything else was looking up and not seeing a dark sky, seeing an incandescent sky of stars, the likes of which I've never seen, the Milky Way. It was just amazing. I've gone back since, and it is still an amazing sky, but some of the light from Las Vegas is encroaching on that environment. And so for me, thinking about this moment, which is kind of a microcosm of the city's relationship with the natural world, is in our perspective, we are kind of masters of it. We have created these elaborate systems to deliver us clean water, to take away our waste, to give us artificial light wherever we want it. And many of us, you know, the natural world, for many of us, is just kind of an irritant, you know, when like you get ants in your house, or it gets cold in the winter, and then you have to turn on the furnace. And but the blackout was both a reminder that our systems are very fragile, that infrastructure that gives us that cocoon against the natural world requires constant maintenance, and that it could all go away. And that system, you know, the water system, wind currents, they're still operating. They still deliver us weather and all the other things. And they don't require, you know, our political systems, our culture, to keep on grinding. And so for me, it's a moment for many Clevelanders who are around my age or older, who can remember having that. For some, it was a panic. For some, I know some of my friends, they say it was one of the best couple of days of their life. The sense of community they got out of it, from no longer being relying on the typical world and having to reach across and meet your neighbors maybe for the first time. And that I felt was a good entry for some of the things I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, and what it spurred me to think about was the idea that this is similar to the way that in recent years there's been a lot of revision of our understanding of indigenous people in North America. You know, that sort of narrative arc is that settlers came, white European culture came and wiped out Native culture. And, you know, whether people feel strongly about that one way or the other, the revision is to say that Native culture has not been wiped out, that it's resilient and powerful, and that people who are indigenous, who are here, they're still around. Their culture still exists. Their ways of life still exist. Their territory has been virtually taken away from them. And Ohio is a really good example, because it was early on, and you talked about this, you know, in a couple of different ways in the book, that the white people who showed up there, they had a couple of things in mind. One was to get rid of all the Native Americans, and also, which I hadn't thought of, get rid of all the wildlife, mm-hmm. because anything that got in the way of agriculture had to be gotten rid of. But where I want to kind of circle back to is that what you really have proposed, in a way, is a notion of revisionism about our understanding of nature. And I'm sure you're not the only one to talk about this, but the idea that we sort of have is that similarly, not only have we kind of pushed away native people, but we've also pushed away nature.
Yeah.
And the reality is nature is still around us. We may have seriously damaged the planet in ways that can never be restored, but the natural systems are still operative. Yeah. So just as you said a minute ago, we do matter. But if you turn off all of this modern culture, nature is going to restore itself in some way. It may not look like what it did before, and it may not, in the short term, it may not be kind of as vibrant and diverse as it was, because we are wiping out in a short period of time the biodiversity of the planet that has taken millions of years to come into being. And, you know, it's just that this modern era, the era of the fossil fuels, which, you know, Cleveland being the home of, has really made a huge impact, which is kind of what, you know, I don't think that you set out to kind of tell that story in such a literal way, but I think you illustrate it really well.
Yeah, I think I hope people, when they pick up this book, they understand what it isn't. And it's not a replacement for your standard history. I'm not going to, you know, tell kind of a comprehensive history of these 14,000 years or so. I think I crunched the numbers, and if I did, I'm in the 240 some pages of this book, it would require like one every page recording 56 years of history, and that is just impossible to do.
Right.
Instead, what it is kind of a challenge and a course correction to the way we've been telling the story of this city and this region. And I want us to rethink that relationship, both for historical purposes, but for also the community that we want to build going forward. That number one, this human story goes back far further than when Cleveland was established, you know, as our signs say, in 1796. I use a kind of reference point to say that, you know, if the first evidence we have of indigenous people being in this region is something like 13.5 thousand years ago, and that if we equate that to a calendar being January 1st, then Europeans don't arrive in our story until about noon on Christmas Day. And to be telling a story about a place that only considers that last week of December seems to miss out on something really important. That, of course, it is dramatically different in many ways from what preceded it, but what those indigenous civilizations were doing is very much what modern Cleveland is trying to do, which is forge a sustainable relationship and hopefully be successful in doing it.
Well, and you, as I think you sort of allude to, and I, you know, that there were urban, smaller, but there were urban settlements throughout Ohio. I think you have, you know, there's mound culture in Ohio pretty extensively, and that kind of relates to Cahokia in southern Illinois, which even relates farther south. We think nobody really knows for sure how mound culture developed. But there were, you know, pretty large, active settlements of people. You know, I think there's always often a sense that Ohio was basically a hunter-gatherer territory because that's kind of what it looked like when the settlers got there. The white, you know, the Europeans showed up, and there weren't as many large-scale settlements when they arrived because disease had wiped out such a large number of people prior to their arrival. Because 1796, maybe that's when post the Revolutionary War, the Western Reserve from, which, you know, that's a Connecticut history that I am aware of because of, because I live in Connecticut. That was part of Connecticut. It was really a colonial settlement. But prior to 1790, there were French and English, not so much doing agriculture, but more, hunting beaver, basically, and try with beaver and other pelts. So there were a lot of things going on. But one of the problems that you kind of allude to is that a lot of that history was not recorded.
Right.
Even on the side, you know, we have the Jesuit relations pretty much. That is what you got for the most part. And a few sensitive French trappers who actually tried to learn the cultural ways of the people who were already there, rather than the English who like to basically kill everybody.
Yeah, this is a difficult problem in history, and particularly for this region, is when Europeans do arrive, it is, how can I put this? This land is very unrepresentative at that time of what it had been for the preceding millennia, where it is kind of a no man's land in many ways. There are scattered hunting parties, but the civilizations that had been there were no longer exerting the same pressure on the land as they once had. And it gave a false impression to the settlers of, you know, what had occurred there before. But here, all along the Ohio River Valley, was one of the hearths of agriculture in the world. Historians refer to it as the EAC, or the Eastern Agricultural Complex. And we know indigenous people here had domesticated, for example, sunflowers, which I see as I drive down the highway. Our modern agriculture still does that, but it was generations of indigenous people who took its wild ancestors and made it into a crop that, you know, can be a source of sustenance and for sedentary societies, as well as many other plants. And whenever around the world, wherever you begin the experiment of domestication of plants and or animals, it invests people in the land in a different way. It allows for sedentary living that is year round in one location, which poses problems, but also offers opportunities. And it led to a flourishing in culture in this region that by the time Europeans arrived was in ruins. The mounds had been grown over. In the same way, there was a story this week out of Central America about this ancient city that had been found in the jungle. And it's the same thing, you know, in those Mayan ruins in the Yucatan. They were discovered, you know, overgrown in the jungle. And that wasn't, you know, the way they were left. They looked much different, you know, when they were an active center of civilization. And the same thing is in Ohio. And it creates this problem for both modern historians and for people of, I encounter many people in the community who ask me, for instance, about land acknowledgments, that how can we acknowledge the indigenous past in a respectful way and the people who made a life here. And there are resources such as nativeland.ca, which provides kind of a map that shows, you know, where certain people were in the region. And the problem with that map is that it's static. And these people, wherever you are looking in the country, were quite mobile. And to freeze a people and a culture in one place, it can be problematic because it doesn't tell the whole story. And if we are looking at Ohio and Northeast Ohio at this time period, there are villages, many of them are almost like refugee communities, indigenous people who are fleeing from colonization in the East, and they are making homes with other indigenous people who, some of which don't even share the same language with them, and they are creating something new. There's a lot of kind of cross-pollination of ideas from different communities, which is a really fascinating story from Ohio's past that doesn't get told that often. But there's nothing like a stable, you know, like confederacy of people that are in this region because of prior wars among indigenous people that are in part propelled by global trade networks, like you mentioned, the trade in beaver and other furs.
Right. And also, there was the dynamic of cultural interaction between indigenous people and early colonial settlers who, the level of death in some of those cultures required them to go out and replace their lost members. That was part of the reason some of those wars took place. It was not to conquer, it was to take captives, to bring them back and to replace lost members of the society so that they could perform the proper roles that were needed for the society to be sustainable. And so, you know, that was going on, I think, for probably 200 or 300 years prior to the arrival of large numbers of Europeans. And I think you mentioned, I think in the book, something I hadn't really thought about. There was someone you mentioned who studied land use evidence in Ohio and noticed that between 1640 and 1740, the use of fire to change the landscape, which is what had been done by native peoples for many, many years, stopped. And so the landscape literally changed between 1640 and 1740. I thought that was really an interesting point. And it kind of reminded me, there's a line, you said one thing that I thought really kind of sums up a lot of the things that we've been talking about. Ohio is haunted by its past. But I think that's true of every place. And, you know, we're all haunted by the past if we allow it to be present to us and be sensitive to it. And I think that's really the value of what you've done, which is you make us look again at what's out there. And, you know, there are other things too. You've talked about a lot of examples of people who are restoring landscape, who are trying to make an urban landscape that is more humane and more natural. So there's a lot of things going on, but I think for me, the most important thing was to use the stories in the book to kind of bring to someone's attention that what's out there in front of them if they want to see it.
Yeah. You know, yesterday was Halloween. Today's Day of the Dead. It's a moment. We sometimes forget this, but especially with Day of the Dead, it's a moment of reflection and, you know, acknowledging our loved ones who have passed. And there are so many books written about haunted Ohio, haunted Cleveland. And I think part of that, the interest in that is getting at people are seeking a connection to the past. And I don't think you necessarily have to see a ghost to do that. You can find it embedded in the landscape, sometimes literally in the shape of, you know, the mounds that are still here, in the bones that wash up of, you know, ancient mastodons right here in Public Square. And kind of the legacy of those decisions. And what troubles me today is that people sometimes turn a blind eye to those things in order to maintain a narrative. You know, so I also teach at Michigan State University. And one of the things that I impress upon my first year students is different biases, confirmation bias being a big one, that we all, for reasons within our psychology, because it has helped us in the past, are more ready to accept information that confirms our worldview and our beliefs. And when we are presented with information that seems to challenge it or go against it, we are immediately skeptical. And so right now, this, we're in election season also. And part of what is that debate is a battle over who controls the past and what narratives get out there. I don't know if you saw it, but just on Tuesday, the Wall Street Journal published a kind of a bombshell of a story about the nation's lead archivist at the National Archives suppressing and changing some of the documents that are on presentation because of fear of upsetting certain people. And although they're somewhat named, it's mostly Republicans who had grilled her in her nomination process. And one of the things that was challenged is on a unit that covered westward expansion. And so, you know, when you talk about Cleveland history, that's part of it. This is the Middle West. Mm-hmm. The Cuyahoga River used to be at one time the boundary between the United States and Indian country, if you will. But the archivist asked the staff, why are there so many things dealing with Indians in this about westward expansion? What a surprise. And as a result, she directed her staff to remove several treaties that showed land cessions by indigenous people that could provide context and tell that story, because she didn't want to upset people about and confront them with that story. And so, like, when I say, you know, we're haunted by the past, I mean those relationships that Cleveland in particular has been a butt of a joke for a long time. And one of the things that I'm hopefully providing an alternative to is that Cleveland's history of the environment begins and ends kind of with the river burning. And the city itself begins with Moses Cleveland and ends with where we are today, that there is a long history that goes before it, and it offers some cautionary tales that we had better learn and we ignore at our own peril. But I think it's also hopeful because if we contextualize that, if we can learn from it, we can remember that the future is unwritten, that we can determine where we go from here, that we're not destined to repeat those problems.
Yeah. Well, no, and in fact, you also mentioned Lewis Mumford, and you think about the early ecology movement that started in the 50s and 60s, mm-hmm. this idea, this sense of the reaction against, the over-industrialization without thought that was taking mm-hmm. place throughout America and all around the world, that it literally did change the arc of history. It took a while, and it didn't, you know, it isn't as if it completely stopped development or made development more conscious, because it hasn't done that, but it did make a big difference. And that things that have, so you have, if you pay attention to history and think about where you are and talk about ideas like this, it will make a difference. People will learn that there can be other ways of being on the earth. That's kind of what we hope will be the case. Otherwise, we're going to end up pessimistically falling off the cliff or jumping off the cliff, which I don't think we want to do. Well, I want to thank you, John. This has been really good. We probably could have talked for a lot longer. So it is proof that a short book can lead to a lot of conversation. I appreciate it. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to John Vlasic, which I hope I said at least minimally correctly, about an alternative history of Cleveland. It's a terrific book. Thank you very much, John.
Great to be here. Thanks.